Oh, you were not aware of this?
Your posterior better contact someone at once!
Ah, the greatness of the Rhodes Scholars. We're going to get to that a little bit later on in the Raw review. They were very entertaining on Monday night. And actually, we've got some pretty entertaining tag teams in wrestling right now between the Rhodes Scholars, Rude and Aries, and TNA, and Bad Influence. If only we had more tag teams for them to actually wrestle against, we could very well be in the middle of another golden period of tag teams in wrestling. This is episode 265 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. I am the Solemn Monster. It is Sunday, March 17th, 2013. Happy St. Paddy's Day to those who celebrate, the Irishmen out there. And for those of you who are still hungover from last night, perhaps the sound off can be your hangover cure here for this Sunday. Check out my latest column on layfieldreport.com this week. It's an interesting subject. I was thinking the other day, you know, what do I want to write about this weekend for JBL's website? What made me happy? What made me angry? And one thing that really upset me this week, if you remember on Raw, Antonio Cesaro tapping out to Alberto Del Rio to the armbar. And Del Rio was the world champion. You know, that's fine, I guess. He should be beating people. But why Cesaro? You know, that was my question. Why Cesaro? And it made me think, you know, it feels like recently we've seen quite a bit of this with Cesaro, the U.S. champion, with Wade Barrett, the Intercontinental champion. It feels like both men have lost, you know, more times than I can remember. For example, to Randy Orton. Randy Orton's pinned both of them about six times, three times a piece. Del Rio's beaten them both. It's just insane to me to think about all the times that these secondary champions in WWE have been beaten on television, and it's never even made to be a big deal. It's just another match, and it's over in 3 or 4 minutes, and Cesaro taps out or Barrett gets pinned. And in some cases, both champions, actually I think on more than one occasion, both champions have been pinned and beaten on the same show, on Raw. And so the headline of my column is it time to retire the Intercontinental and U.S. titles? I say it is, unless they're ready to, you know, to change their ways and start treating the champions with more respect and treat the titles as something important. My whole thing is, why even have secondary titles in the first place? You've got your world titles. You've got two of them. I don't even think you need that many. But you've got your two world titles. What is the purpose of having an Intercontinental champion if he's just beaten on television? And it's not even a situation where the person beating him is getting a title shot. You know, maybe I'm old school. You know, I'm not that old, but I'm old school in that I was always of the impression that if you were a champion, even if you were in a non-title match against somebody, if that person beat you, and if you read my column, I give an example from 93 with Shawn Michaels and Tatanka. I was always of the impression that if you beat the champion, you therefore shoot up to become the number one contender for said title. I mean, I can't think of a better way to earn yourself a title shot than beating the champion in a non-title match. Or, even better, if you beat the champion, you become the champion. And it seems like that's not the philosophy anymore. Somewhere along the way, that kind of fell to the wayside. Something changed. I don't know. I can't pinpoint exactly when that change occurred. But it's a bad change. I don't like it. It doesn't make sense. And it bothers me that we even have these meaningless titles if they're either never going to be defended or if the champions are just going to be beaten and stepped on like you know, a common jabroni. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So that's the nature of the column this week. I gave specific examples. I went back and checked the win-loss records for both champions so far in 2013, and it just left me shaking my head. So check that column out right now. It's up on layfieldreport.com. I posted a link to it on my Facebook page. There's a whole big discussion and debate going on back and forth. You can leave me some feedback. I'm curious what you think. You know, it's not that I want to see, for example, the Intercontinental title go away. I was very upset in 2002 when they retired the Intercontinental Championship then, when Triple H beat Kane to essentially unify the IC belt with the World Heavyweight title. I didn't like that, and I was happy in 2003 when they brought the belt back. I have a soft spot for the Intercontinental title, especially the old look, which they've since brought back. I think it's a nice-looking belt and all that, but it's great that it looks nice, but what's the point? And if that's the way it's going to be treated as an afterthought, then you may as well get rid of the goddamn thing. So anyway, check out my column. Let me know what you think. We're going to do things a little bit differently this week because there was a lot of big TNA news. So we're going to start with TNA for a change. They had their lockdown pay-per-view from the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, Texas last Sunday. Apparently 6,700 people, no matter what they may claim, that was the legit attendance for lockdown, which in any other building I think would be very good. In the Alamo Dome, probably not so much. Again, my question still stands. Why the Alamo Dome? I mean, it sounds cool, but unless you can fit... You don't even have to pack in the Alamo Dome. I don't expect WWE or TNA, you know, for a non-WrestleMania event to be able to pack in 60 or 70,000 people. You know, if TNA was going to get 15 or 20,000, then okay, maybe, but I still don't understand why they ran that building. But I went 6-2 in my lockdown predictions. My biggest one, of course, came to fruition, as many people have been predicting for months. Bully Ray finally turning heel. I could even say turning heel because he never really was a babyface. That was the swerve. It was all a ruse. It was all a plan. 9 months in the making. Bully Ray, the new World Heavyweight Champion, beating Jeff Hardy in the main event, being revealed as the president of Aces and Eights. And I am so happy that Bully stuck with TNA and did not jump to WWE. If you remember, there was some rumors and stories out there right around the time of Bound for Glory, a little before Bound for Glory last year. We know the contract situation with D-Von, which was legit, and he disappeared for a while, then they brought him back. And there was some question about whether Bully was going to stay in TNA. His contract was coming up. Would he jump back to WWE? Would they allow him to be the Bully Ray character? Even if he was, you know, Bubba and not Bully, would they allow him to be that same persona? Would they allow him to be a bully? Would they allow him to push the envelope the way that we all know he can? I wasn't confident that they could. I mean, look, I'm a WWE fan. I'd love to see, for example, the Bully Ray character and, you know, Aries and Rude and all these people one day on WWE television with some fresh faces to step inside the ring with. I just have no faith that they would be able to maintain the integrity of these characters. And so I thought that TNA was the best place for Bully Ray. I couldn't see Bully Ray being allowed to break through as a main event guy in WWE. It might be harder, I think, for him to break that tag team stigma. Although I must say, a Bully Ray-John Cena feud, if played the right way, I think could be money. And who knows, maybe one day it will be. But I think he made the right call, and it really all came to fruition last Sunday. It really stood out for me that this guy has now won his first singles world championship. He is now the top heel in the company, maybe one of the top heels in the entire business, if they allow him to be. And I'm very happy for him because he's worked his ass off. You know, he's in the best shape of his life. He was given an opportunity. He ran with it. He made the most of it. And I am really enjoying, and it's only been a week, but I am really enjoying the evil turn for Bully Ray. This is the perfect role for him. You know, I've said all along, I never bought into him as a babyface. I mean, he's got the word bully in his name. And I've just felt that he's gone way too soft, the stuff with Brooke, the wedding and everything. And I pretty much knew this was coming. I was just hoping they wouldn't think, well, you know, everybody knows it's coming, so let's swerve them and do something else. And to their credit, to TNA's credit, they didn't do that. They stuck to their guns. This was the plan all along, months in the making, as I said. And they gave it to us. And you know what? It paid off because from what I saw of the lockdown pay-per-view, honestly, it wasn't a great show. There were some good matches. The main event, though, the post-match angle sold it for me. I thought it was very, very well done. You know, people throwing trash in the ring. You know, it's a great visual for us watching at home, but I got to tell you, and this would, you know, I felt the same way about the stuff when they would do that on Nitro back in the day with the NWO. If I'm in that audience, if I'm in the first, like, 5 or 10 rows, I'm not very happy when people start chucking glass bottles at the ring and throwing trash and debris. I wouldn't be very happy about that at all, especially if I get hit in the face by it. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that's such a good idea. The company could get itself in some trouble if certainly they're encouraging people to throw trash. I don't know if they are or not. There was somebody who went to the tapings in Chicago on Thursday who said towards the end or maybe off air, people started throwing trash. They could have sworn that they saw a stagehand off to the side kind of waving at the crowd, almost like encouraging them to throw trash. I don't know if that's what they were doing. I hope not. If so, I think that's just dumb, especially if it's in plain view of the fans. If somebody gets hurt, and you can prove that TNA was encouraging that type of behavior, I don't know how bright that is. But you know, for the pay-per-view, it certainly made for a good visual. The guys were in the cage, so they were kind of shielded from some of the debris. It was a chaotic scene at the end of that pay-per-view, and for the first time, it really made me interested in where they're going with this whole Aces and Eights thing. I'm not going to sit here and say that I've turned a corner on Aces and Eights necessarily. I've turned a corner on their theme song. I actually think it's pretty badass. But the thing about the Aces and Eights, it still doesn't make any sense why they lost, you know, for all those months. It still doesn't make any sense to me. For example, you know, Bully Ray at the wedding got beat up, and not only did he get beat up, but they hit him in the head with like a stone. I don't even know what that was. It was like a pew or something like that. I guess you can kind of explain it by saying, you know, if Bully was not attacked by Aces and Eights like everybody else was over the last couple of months, that would have probably, you know, given reason to be a little suspicious of him. So you can kind of sort of argue that's why they did it, that's why it did make sense, and that's fine. But why Aces and Eights has been made to look so weak over the last several months, you know, to me, that's still a huge gap in logic that needs to be explained. But having said that, now that we know all of the members of Aces and Eights, or at least I assume we do. I mean, I guess there could still be some grand leader like Bischoff or somebody that they want to reveal at some point. But now that we don't have guys walking around faceless, you know, wearing masks, we know who they are. Bully, I think, is perfect for this role. He was freaking awesome, I thought, on Thursday night. And again, it's only one night, but I really am cautiously optimistic, perhaps is the best way to say it, about where this Aces and Eights thing goes. They were made to look stronger on Thursday night than they have in the last 6 or 7 months. You know, they came out at the beginning of the show on Impact on Thursday night. It was a scene that was ripped right from the old days of WCW Monday Nitro, you know, where the NWO would come out and would just randomly attack people. I mean, obviously, that's where this whole thing is ripped off from, and it's really not a great surprise. I mean, look at who's at the helm in TNA right now. You've got Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff, the two men who were pretty much on top, behind the scenes and on camera, in WCW back in the day. They're going back to the well. They're going with what they think still works, and I guess we'll find out. I mean, I know Impact's ratings were down a little bit on Thursday, which was kind of surprising. But I thought, you know, hot start to the show on Thursday night. They introduced Bully. He got some great heat. I thought, by the way, I thought the Chicago crowd on Thursday was great. It was lively. It made it really feel like a major league presentation I've been seeing for years. They have to get out of the Impact zone. And again, to their credit, they cut bait. The lease is up. They're not going back. They can't go back. They're all in with these road shows. And this was only one show. And from the reports that I read, I didn't read the spoilers, but from the reports that people sent in who were there on Thursday at the tapings, they taped two shows. They're doing a live 1 week, tape the next week kind of formula. The crowd is more dead for next week's show, which that could be a problem for them going forward, because you tape two shows, you know, 4 hours worth of television in one night. You know, people are going to get burned out for that second taping. So that may be something they have to address at some point. But for the first taping, for the live one, I thought the crowd was fantastic. I don't know exactly how many people they had there. They had at least, you know, a few thousand. So it really helps. It really just makes it feel more major league. And I really like the Aces and Eights segment also that opened the show. You know, as I said before, ripoff as it may have been of the NWO, it worked. You know, and with Bully out there, Bully just brings something to that group that they didn't have before. I hasten to use the word credibility, because I still don't look at Aces and Eights as a terribly credible group. I mean, given all the matches they've lost, it just feels like for every 10 matches Aces and Eights would have, they would lose 8. It's hard to take a group of guys like that seriously. But when Bully was out there, it felt hot. You know, he was like a heat magnet out there. And there were a few, you know, TNA trolls on Twitter trashing the finish of the pay-per-view for being predictable. Oh, they went with Bully Ray. You know, we knew this was going to happen for months. It sucked because Bully's turn was predictable. You know, let this be a lesson. It's not always a bad thing to be predictable. You know, again, I've been calling the Bully thing, as many people have, for months, ever since he started going soft. And they could have swerved us for the surprise, but they didn't. So, Bully is back where he belongs as the villain. In one night, both at the pay-per-view and then on Impact, you know, so I guess two nights. He made me more interested in Aces and Eights. That alone is a victory unto itself for at least 1 week. I never thought that would be something that would be possible, but they certainly did make it possible. So anyway, Team TNA at the pay-per-view, by the way, they did beat the Aces and Eights, which, again, just proves my point. But at least there, I guess you can make the argument. The reason that Aces and Eights lost in that match is to make the ending of the pay-per-view feel more impactful. So I can excuse that. But anyway, back to Impact on Thursday night. There was a hell of a Knockouts match on that show. I can't even remember the last time we saw a Divas match on Raw. I know there's been Divas tag matches on SmackDown. But Raw is the A show. And I can't remember the last time that, for example, Caitlyn, the Divas champion, had a match. It's literally been a month or more, I think. And so it's nice to be able to watch Impact and to see what I thought, anyway, was a pretty good, you know, by Divas and Knockout standards, because these can be sloppy at times, I thought this was a pretty good tag team match. One thought I had after watching the women on Thursday was the idea of adding a female to the Aces and Eights faction. And I would be in favor of the idea. I think it would be, you know, interesting to have a female presence in the group. And why not Eva Lise? You know, Eva Lise Velez, she was the one who got kicked off the last gut check in favor of Lady Tapa. Because, you know, I guess her uncle is the Barbarian, so we have to give her the benefit of the doubt, even though she's completely green. But Eva Lise has a built-in beef with TNA in that she thought she should have won gut check. She's got 9 years of experience to the other chicks, too. She could join the Aces and Aces as a way to kind of get back at TNA, and she's pretty good. She's hot, you know, which always helps. So just an idea I was thinking of if that was, you know, something they wanted to go in. We see all the Aces and Eights guys, you know, attacking Kurt Angle and Eric Young and Magnus and everybody else. It would be nice to see someone like Eva Lise, if they bring in a knockout into their group, go around beating up some of the knockouts as well and bring the knockouts into this whole Aces and Eights thing. Just running down some of the other things here on Impact, I lost some of my notes that I scribbled down after the show, so just bear with me here. Speaking of Bad Influence, I mentioned them earlier. Daniels and Kazarian continue to entertain. They came out here in Chicago on this show dressed up as the Road Warriors. And my first comment when I saw this was, who let the air out of the Road Warriors? It's kind of like, I think I've told the story before, years ago for Halloween, I dressed up as Hulk Hogan. And I'm waiting in line to go into a bar somewhere in Manhattan. You have to show your ID. You're going in. Guy takes a look at me. He looks at my ID. He looks at me again. I'm wearing the Hogan yellow shirt, the bandana, the armbands, the whole nine yards. And turns around to me and he says, you know, who put Hulk Hogan in the dryer? Well, that's kind of how I felt about this when I saw Daniels and Kazarian out here. It's like, God, who stuck a pin in the Road Warriors and let air out of them? But aside from that, they had the face paint. You know, Kazarian had the big spider on his forehead. And Daniels was funny. He had, I think Taz described them as skid marks at one point. He had face paint basically on top of his head, making it look like he had Hawk's old, you know, hairdo, mohawk, whatever the hell you call it. They were very entertaining, as they are pretty much every single week. James Storm came out. He challenged Daniels to a match. He beat Daniels. AJ Styles made his big return on this show, looking a little less like a hobo this week. Not much, but a little bit. And AJ comes out. He beats up Daniels. He beats up Kazarian. James Storm is in there standing side by side with AJ. Styles, by the way, doing a complete ripoff of Sting's 1998 Crow gimmick, only without the face paint. And so anyway, Styles and Storm were standing next to each other. And all of a sudden, Styles goes and he clotheslines James Storm. But he clotheslines him so hard. You know, AJ came down with a hoodie. He had a hood on. He took the hood off. He clotheslined Storm so hard that AJ's hood propelled back over his head. So, a lot of impact there on that clothesline. And then he walked away. And that was that. So, my guess is this. This is what I figure we're looking at here. We're probably looking at the build to a Bully Ray AJ Styles match at Bound for Glory in October for the championship. That would be my guess. I guess the only other question is, you know, they're really building up the bad blood between Bully and Hulk Hogan. to the point where it would make you think that they're building to a Bully Hogan match. Now, Hogan just had knee surgery, and I remember months ago Hogan teased that he was going to come back. He wanted to be the TNA champion. He only had one more surgery left to go, brother, and then I'm going to be on the way back. Well, he had knee surgery a few weeks ago or a month ago, whatever it was, and is still recovering from that. And I figured it was just the usual Hogan bluster, but you know, you look at the storyline here, and it makes me wonder if Hogan really is serious about coming back for one more match, and I don't like that idea at all. Hogan should not be in the ring wrestling ever again. Ever. First of all, he's 60 years old. That's number one. When you get to a certain age, it's probably just not a good idea to step in the ring anymore. Hogan is just so broken down, and I feel sorry for him in this respect. You know, the back surgeries that he's had, that can't be fun. Back pain, neck pain, that's some of the worst pain imaginable. I've had neck pain before, some neck issues. It's not fun. And it seems like Hogan's, you know, is doing better as far as his back is concerned. I would hate to think of him stepping back in the ring and taking one bad flat back bump and, you know, putting his back out or his hip out or... This is not a good idea. So I don't know if that's what they're planning to do. Maybe they're planning to do Bully and Hogan at Slammiversary. And have smoke and mirrors. They have a pay-per-view main event. Bully wins. And then, again, they continue building to the Bully-AJ match. Or, God forbid, if they're building to Bully and Hogan at Bound for Glory, their biggest show of the year. I don't like that idea at all. And at some point, they're going to have to get away from this Hogan stuff. It's fine for now because, you know, Bully was married to Hulk's daughter. And obviously, there's a lot of tension and bad blood there now. And if Hogan wants to hire some assassins to go after him, you know... Or have a surrogate in his place, kind of like Vince and Donald Trump. See, even WWE was smart enough at WrestleMania 23 not to have Vince and Trump in a match. You know, they had Trump pick Bobby Lashley. They had Vince pick Umaga. They did some spots where they beat each other up outside, but that was it. Because they realized these guys are old, and they should not be in the ring wrestling each other. So if that's what they're going to do with Hogan, I'm fine with that. I do not need to see Hulk Hogan back in the ring. I certainly hope that's not what they're planning to do. There was a segment on the show with Joseph Park. He was in his home city of Chicago, very over with the crowd. His colleagues from Park apparently were there in attendance, although they had seats up in the nosebleeds because Joseph doesn't exactly have a lot of pull backstage to get them front row seats. Matt Morgan came out. He's big. I don't know what else there is to say about Matt Morgan. He doesn't do anything for me at all. They're trying, and it's just not working. But apparently there's going to be a match next week. It'll be Matt Morgan against Joseph Park. And as I said on Twitter, I certainly hope for Joe Park's sake that he is an estate attorney and can prepare his own will, because I don't like his chances in the ring against Matt Morgan next week. The main event on Impact was a unique match I don't think they've ever done before, Austin Aries against Sting. And again, I saw some people trashing the match online. I was doing some live tweeting during the show, and people were kind of mocking the match and saying, you know, this is a crappy match. Sting is old. Well, yes, Sting is old. Sting is 54 years old. He's not quite 60 like Hogan. And to his credit, Sting can still move around a hell of a lot better than most 54-year-olds in wrestling. But yes, Sting is old. He does not move as fast as he used to. And I thought Aries did a hell of a job here, because I actually thought they had a pretty good match. They were in there for... I mean, it was probably about 12 to 15 minutes or so. They had a pretty long match, all things considered. Sting held up his end. Aries did a phenomenal job. I thought it was a good main event that had some star power. I can't remember seeing an Aries-Sting match before. It was a unique match. And ordinarily, I might say a match that you would want to save for pay-per-view, but now that they only have 4 pay-per-views a year, I guess they're more apt to give away matches like this on free TV, so it was fine. End of the show, Hogan had pretty much the entire TNA roster run out to go after the Aces and Eights. Aces and Eights, by the way, interfered in the match. I assume Sting got the disqualification win. They never really announced it. So Aces and Eights is out there beating up on Sting. Hogan limps out on his crutches. All of a sudden, Jeff Hardy comes running out. Samoa Joe. I've never seen Samoa Joe run so fast in my life. I couldn't tell if they were dangling a cheeseburger in the ring or something like that. He runs down to the ring. Everybody just comes out from the locker room. Big brawl at the end of the show. And for the first time, Aces and Eights gets the upper hand. Aces and Eights, they put down the TNA roster. And this is what I'm talking about. In one night, they tried to undo all the damage they've done with Aces and Eights. And they didn't do that, as far as I'm concerned, but it's a step in the right direction. Because if the Aces and Eights group is going to stick around for many more months, you've got to do something to make people think that they're at least a mildly serious threat, which nobody believes right now. They're a complete joke. Bully, I think, can help, and this was a step in the right direction. So that was Impact from Thursday, a very enjoyable show. I enjoyed it a lot. I think being on the road is going to be a huge benefit for them. It took them far too long to get out of that Impact zone. It was a nice little facility, but they outgrew it. It just made them look completely low rent. This show made them look major league, and I want to see more of it. And I look forward to Impact going on the road and being in new buildings and being in front of new fans. Then sometimes they'll be hot like they were Thursday. Sometimes they won't be. But that's something they need to get to that next level. TNA will never get to that next level if they don't get out more in other places other than just Orlando. So quick update here on Rob Van Dam. You'll notice he wasn't at the pay-per-view last week. Would have made sense for him to be part of that X Division title match, and he was not. And he wasn't on Impact Thursday either. And Van Dam has posted some comments online. His contract apparently is up. He's technically now a free agent, although he is in discussions with TNA. If I had to venture a guess, much like Bobby Roode, remember last week I made mention of there being a contract situation. That was quickly resolved. Bobby Roode is, you know, back under TNA contract and happy. My guess would be RVD stays with TNA. It's obvious this guy doesn't like the WWE road schedule, and I don't know that they would give him a schedule that would allow him, you know, so much more time off than everybody else. Rob Van Dam, as great of an athlete as he is, for example, is not The Rock. He's not Brock Lesnar. My guess is RVD stays in TNA, even if it is on a maybe an even more reduced schedule. I don't know. I don't know if it's more of a money issue or what the deal is. Maybe he's not happy that Impact's going on the road. You know, he had his very safe, easy flight to and from Orlando every week. He worked, you know, one or two nights and that maybe a few house shows, and that was it. Now he's got to go on the road like everybody else. I guess we'll see. But my guess would be RVD stays put. I don't see him back right now in WWE. Speaking of WWE, we had Raw Monday night from Indianapolis, Indiana. Raw ended at 11:15 p.m. this week. That is 3 hours and 15 minutes of WWE television on Monday night. The main event with Kane and CM Punk didn't even start until just after 11 o'clock. And then they took a commercial break 5 minutes later. First time I can ever remember that, them taking a commercial break in the overrun like that. I still don't understand for the life of me why we need an overrun on a three-hour show. I know it takes a lot of hard work to put together a live weekly television show, you know, let alone one that's 3 hours. I think what happens here is they have all this extra time to fill. And so they fill it with more segments, you know, and movie trailers and stuff like that. And it just drags everything down. I mean, I thought the first half of Raw Monday was actually quite good. But after that, it just went off a cliff. That last hour, I don't know what the hell that last hour was. And there's one segment in that last hour, and I think you know which one I'm talking about here, that we're going to get to, that I am still flabbergasted by, that it even made the air. I would love to see them cut the show down from what it is now to 2 hours from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. You know, that 8 o'clock hour has become consistently the highest rated hour. And third hour is the lowest because the show is just so goddamn long. I mean, people just tune out. And I mean, they've had some third hours with some pretty good segments. I mean, you know, the Cena Punk match they had all those weeks ago was one of the best matches in Raw history. And a big match for them to promote. I mean, Cena and Punk are two of the biggest stars in the company. You would think that, if anything, I mean, that would help keep people around. And I don't remember offhand. I remember the main event did very, very well, but I think even that third hour may have been down. It's just that's the pattern. You know, it starts high, and it just gradually gets lower and lower as the 3 hours go on. Just air Raw from 8 to 10. You know, that way I've got an extra hour after the show ends to relax before I go to bed and do whatever I want. So, selfishly, I would love to have that extra hour. I have that extra hour when Impact goes off the air on Thursdays, because Impact is from 8 to 10 on Spike. And, you know, having the extra hour before it's even 11 o'clock, it helps. You know, whether I just sit there and watch something else, or if I actually go, you know, try and be productive and do stuff, You know, when the clock hits 11 o'clock, I'm never in bed, personally. I'm more of a night person. But when the clock hits 11, just mentally, it does something, you know, especially if you have work the next day. I like having the extra hour. I would not mind if the show was 8 to 10 and not the traditional 9 to 11. And looking at the ratings and the numbers, it might actually work out better for them. So that's what I would love to see. I know the plan is to keep the show as 3 hours for the foreseeable future. The show's actually been doing pretty good, especially for 3 hours. I mean, they've been doing very good numbers over the last several weeks, and that's all well and good. Let's see what happens in mid-April, when WrestleMania season is over. It always happens. WrestleMania ends, and the numbers start to dip. See what happens. I mean, maybe it doesn't dip. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the three-hour Raws continue to go up, up, and away, and people are very excited about what they're seeing, and there's no reason to change from the three-hour pattern. Maybe, you know, you and I and the people who complain about 3 hours are the 1%. I think the percent is a little bit higher than that. Maybe I'm wrong. But there's no reason for this show to have an overrun. It's just, it's insane. It just doesn't make any sense. Undertaker had a tribute to Paul Bearer at the beginning of the show. That was a very, very, to me anyway, memorable Raw moment there. You know, if I make another list of top Raw moments, you know, years from now when Raw hits its 25th anniversary or 30th anniversary, that'll be a moment on that list for sure. They had Undertaker come out after showing a Paul Bearer tribute video. He went in the ring. There was an urn sitting in the ring, and Undertaker knelt down and saluted the urn. There's a great shot I posted on my Twitter of Undertaker kneeling down with the urn in front of him, and in the background they put a graphic up on the Titantron, an in memory of graphic to Bill Moody, aka Paul Bearer. That sight right there before CM Punk's music hit, that was a great sight. And I'm really going to miss seeing those two together. That really hit home for me that we're never ever going to see the Undertaker come down to the ring managed by Paul Bearer again. That made me very sad. They also aired random Paul Bearer moments throughout the night, which I thought was a nice touch. They had footage of his very first appearance on the Brother Love show when Brother Love introduced him as Brother Paul. Paul Bearer, as he said. They showed, you know, the introduction of Kane in 97. I can't believe they showed the WrestleMania 11 commercial where Paul was dressed in drag, but it's a good illustration of the fact that the guy was willing to poke fun at himself. He was willing to do anything. It was very entertaining. As you could probably tell from that little audio tribute I put together on the Sound Off last week, which, by the way, I got a lot of positive feedback on that. I just want to say thank you for that. I appreciate that. I enjoyed putting that together. I went through a lot of old Paul Bearer, Percy Pringle clips. Just wanted to pick some of the more entertaining ones and just put a little something together, as I've done before. So I just want to say thank you. No Hall of Fame announcement on this show, which was a bit of a surprise. I knew that they had flown his sons in, Daniel and Michael. They flew them into the show in Indianapolis. They were backstage. I thought for sure that was a surefire sign they were going to make the announcement. They wanted maybe his sons to be there for it, but they never did. They never did make the announcement. I mean, they still could, I suppose. I think it's less likely now. I think if they were going to announce Paul Bearer for the Hall of Fame, this week was the week to do it, which makes me think they may wait until next year in New Orleans. You know, again, I've said before, New Orleans apparently was a city that, you know, Percy loved. He would go to Mardi Gras quite often. Maybe that's the idea, you know. Maybe they're going to do it next year. The CM Punk stuff, which that's been a big subject this week of conversation. I wasn't offended by it. I was upset they did it just because it ruined a really nice moment. As I said on Twitter, you know, they can't help themselves. They just can't help themselves. I just thought it interrupted a moment that did not need to be interrupted. Would have been nice to have Undertaker and Kane do a tribute to Paul Bearer without that, but to call it offensive, you know, would not be fair. This was not Eddie is in hell. You know what I mean? Or you've got JR being told in a skit by Vince McMahon days after he had life-threatening colon surgery, you know, oh, you got your head up your ass, JR. I mean, this wasn't the same thing. And you know what? I got my tribute. As I said last week, I wanted to see Undertaker and Kane out there doing some sort of salute. And I got that. At the end of the show, Kane beat CM Punk. Undertaker came back out on stage. And so with Undertaker on stage and Kane in the ring, they both knelt down and they saluted Paul Bearer. And I thought for those few seconds before, again, it was interrupted, It was a very, very cool moment. So I got my tribute. I'm happy. What is pushing things a little bit, I think, is Punk and Heyman walking around with the urn as though Paul Bearer's ashes are actually inside, which apparently is what they did at one of the house shows this weekend. And there have been varying reports from people who were at the show saying that they kind of insinuated that Paul Bearer's ashes were in the urn, and one person said they flat out said that Paul Bearer was in the urn. I think that's pushing the boundaries of taste just a little bit. That I think is going a little too far, but none of this really offended me. It takes a lot to offend me, so I didn't get all bent out of shape about it, but like I said, it would have been nice to have a moment like this kind of self-contained without the typical wrestling bullshit that just screams, this is a storyline. You know what I mean? That's really what this was. A couple of other things from Raw. We had the Shield attacking Big Show. Roman Reigns is, he's going to be a big baby face if these guys play their cards right. I've said before, I think Roman Reigns is the breakout star of the Shield once the time comes to break them up. I think I may have said that on episode 253 when I did my predictions. Roman Reigns is going to be a big baby face. I don't have a doubt about it in my mind. As long as he can stay healthy and they don't fuck things up with the Shield, which they haven't. They've done very well with it so far. He's a big star in the making. They had a match between Daniel Bryan and Dolph Ziggler, which Dolph Ziggler incredibly won, which is a rare thing for Dolph Ziggler because he doesn't win very often, which might make you say to yourself, well, why is that? If they're so high on him and he's such a great athlete and he's got the Money in the Bank briefcase, why does he lose so often? I don't have an answer for you, just like I don't have an answer on why the champions get beat every week. You're asking the wrong person. But for this show, they had a great match. I enjoyed it very much. I remember them having great matches when Bryan first came in to WWE, and he was a babyface singles guy. I think they had some pay-per-view matches, actually, for the U.S. title, and that was back in 2010, and those matches were freaking awesome. So imagine now these guys have only gotten better over time. I would not mind seeing Bryan and Ziggler tear it up one year at WrestleMania. So this was a really good match. The reports are that Dolph Ziggler at WrestleMania will not be in a singles match. Dolph Ziggler may well be teaming with Big E Langston against Bryan and Kane for the tag team titles. And to that I say, if it gives us more Bryan and Ziggler in the ring at WrestleMania, then I'm okay with it. Especially if they... What I would do, if that's the match they do, which is not a match that Dolph Ziggler should be in. Dolph Ziggler, I think, has earned the right to have himself a really... potentially classic singles match at WrestleMania. I was hoping they would do Ziggler and Jericho, and apparently that's not the direction they're going in. But if they're going to do this match, have Kane and Bryan win, retain their titles, Ziggler loses again, yes, but he cashes in Money in the Bank later on in the show. So that would mean they can't open the show with a World Heavyweight Championship match, which they should not. I say don't open the show with a world title match. You can open the show with this match. Give these guys a good 15 minutes to go out there, have a great tag team match. Let Ziggler take the fall. For a change, I think it would make sense. Let Ziggler tap out to the the no-lock. And then Ziggler comes back out later on and beats Swagger or beats Del Rio and wins the world title. That's how I would book it. We had Fandango on this show. Once again, he comes out for a match. He refuses to wrestle because they don't pronounce his name right. We've seen this shit before. This is a great gimmick, by the way. Great gimmick. He also did the worst Val Venus impersonation I've ever heard, did Fandango. The reports for him at WrestleMania, if you can believe it, are that he may well be working a match with Chris Jericho. And I don't know whose idea this is. I don't know if this was something Jericho volunteered for. He wants to work with Johnny Curtis, or if this is just something they... decided to put Jericho in. Supposedly the undercard for WrestleMania got blown up a few weeks ago by Vince McMahon. He flipped out, as he is known to do. He changed a whole bunch of things, and this may well have been one of those changes. So it looks like we may be getting Jericho and Fandango at WrestleMania. I don't know if that means Fandango's going to actually make his debut at WrestleMania. He's not going to wrestle a match until then. I don't know, but I don't even know what to say to that. Obviously for Jericho, it sucks. For Fandango, it could be a huge opportunity for him to go out there and have a classic WrestleMania match with Chris Jericho. I mean, that could be a star-making moment for him if he goes out there and has a great performance. So, yeah, for him, it's a great opportunity. I can't exactly say that Chris Jericho and Fandango is a match that gets me very excited, but that's supposedly the idea right now. I guess we'll see if these reports are accurate or if they're completely full of shit, but they're coming from some pretty reliable sources, so I guess we shall see. The greatness of the Rhodes Scholars. I mentioned that earlier on. You heard the intro. They came out. They were scheduled for a match with the New Age Outlaws. And so Cody and Damian Sandow came out. They did their own version of the Outlaws entrance, which was priceless. Very happy these men are seemingly back together for good. I don't think they're on their little reunion tour. I think they basically just put them back together because they realize, A, we don't have any plans for them, and B, why the hell are we breaking up one of the best acts that we have on TV? It just seems like a boneheaded idea. So the Outlaws came out. I was very happy to see them. I still think they've got one small run left in them. And I wouldn't mind if they put the tag team titles on them. It's a feel-good moment. Put the belts on them. Let them have their little run. And then they can put somebody else over. Maybe they could put over the Rhodes Scholars. Or they could put over a new team. But evidently, they never intended for the Outlaws to have another run at all, based on what they did on this show. They had a match that went all of a minute when Brock Lesnar's theme hit. And Cody Rhodes had this great look of terror on his face. They didn't zoom down to show any piss running down his leg. Wouldn't shock me if there was. He bailed. Sandow bailed. The Outlaws were left alone to die in the ring. Lesnar came in. He beat up Billy Gunn. Gave him an F5. Picked up Road Dogg. Gave him an F5. And Paul Heyman cut a promo, basically on Triple H, accepting Triple H's match at WrestleMania if Triple H agrees that Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman can choose the stipulation for the match, and they will only do so after Triple H has signed the contract. So basically putting Triple H between a rock and a hard place here. If he wants the match, he's got to agree to it without even knowing what the stipulation is going to be. And I guess Triple H is being promoted for Raw this Monday night. We'll hear from him. But again, based on what we saw here, I don't think the Outlaws are back on TV at all. I think they were just brought back this one week to get killed by Brock to help promote the Triple H Brock Lesnar match at WrestleMania. So that's kind of disappointing to me, I have to say. It makes sense that Brock would go after people close to Triple H. I don't know if that means he's going to beat up X-Pac next week or if they're going to bring back Shawn Michaels to have his other arm broken. Wouldn't actually surprise me at all if they brought Shawn Michaels back just because they love having Shawn Michaels on the WrestleMania show in some way. So we may well see him back on TV in the next few weeks. It's funny, you know, when Brock Lesnar's music hit on Monday night, I tweeted that when his music hits, you get this rush. Like, you just know somebody is about to get killed. There really is nobody else on the roster like it. The closest thing they have would be Mark Henry. He's the closest thing right now in WWE promoted to being a real monster. You know, perhaps you could say Ryback is a distant third, because I don't look at Ryback as having as much oomph as he did a couple of months ago. But Brock is really a very unique character in that respect. He's the only guy on the roster who, when he walks out, I think even the average wrestling fan who may not even know who he is, looks at him and looks at his face and looks at his mannerisms and just says to themselves, this guy looks like somebody who could really kill me. Because I don't think anybody really looks at anyone else on the WWE roster the same way. So I tweeted that, and apparently I'm not the only one who thinks this. The WWE Universe Twitter account retweeted my message, as did over 130 other people. And I'm still waiting for them to make those Money in the Bank lunchboxes that I tweeted about once, which they also picked up on. Mark Henry and Ryback, they did a little something on this show here where they tried to one-up each other. And poor Drew McIntyre, this was after they had a match on this show where 3MB got beaten. And so Drew McIntyre is in the ring, and he took a World's Strongest Slam from Mark Henry. He took a Shell Shock from Ryback. And he took another World's Strongest Slam. Took another Shell Shock. Took another World's Strongest. You see where I'm going with this. He got his ass handed to him. I'm amazed that the man is not in traction right now in the hospital. They announced on Raw that Ryback and Henry were going to have a singles match on SmackDown, which made me kind of do a double take and go, what? It doesn't make any sense. Why would you blow that off on TV and not save it for WrestleMania? So I figured they probably weren't even going to do the match on SmackDown. And technically they did. They started it. The match itself never happened. The Shield ran out. They powerbombed Ryback. Mark Henry came back. He gave Ryback three World's Strongest Slams. So that match is on for WrestleMania. It's not officially announced. Pay no attention to the tease they did of Ryback being the one to team up with Sheamus and Orton against the Shield at the pay-per-view. They, you know, the Big Show came up to Sheamus and Orton backstage and basically said, listen, you know, all three of us have a beef with the Shield. Basically saying, let me be your partner. They turned him down. Pay no attention to that. Big Show is going to be in that match. He'll be their partner. And Ryback will face Mark Henry at WrestleMania. I mean, there are people actually saying, oh, my God, you know, well, what's Big Show going to do now at WrestleMania? Again, it's just a temporary roadblock to the inevitable. Big Show, well, what would they do with Big Show if he wasn't in that Shield match? There really is no other role for him. Obviously, he'll be in that match. Alberto Del Rio beat Antonio Cesaro with the armbar. Again, they couldn't find anyone else on the entire roster. They had to job out the United States champion again. Sheamus and Randy Orton beat the Road Scholars. Road Scholars got sent back out because their match with the Outlaws really never happened. So Vicky said they would have another match. That was against Orton and Sheamus. They lost. The movie stuff. This is what I wanted to talk about here. My God, the movie stuff. Whose bright idea was it to have Dead Man Down, The Call, and the Marine 3 all come out at once? What a boneheaded move that was. So they're promoting all three movies at once, which means on a three-hour show, about 2.5 hours of it was promotion for the movies. We had movie trailers, we had talk about the movie, we had talk about how great the Marine did on DVD its first week out, we had another Dead Man Down trailer, and then we had a skit with Halle Berry, which I actually thought was kind of amusing. They did this whole thing with, you know, David Otunga calls her and says, you know, I hope you don't mind. I know you told me not to give your number out, but it's possible that one of the, you know, WWE superstars got your number. Sorry. And he hung up. And then all of a sudden she gets another call on her cell phone, and it's Kane, who's at an arena somewhere, I guess, getting ready for the show. And Kane is like, oh, you won't return my calls. You won't return my texts. So stalker boyfriend Kane could be a very interesting gimmick change for him, especially if they tie it back to the Katie Vick storyline and reveal that Katie didn't really die in an accident after all. She wanted to end the relationship with Kane, and Kane just told her, if I can't have you, no one can. As you can see, I've given this way too much thought, had way too much free time on my hands this week, apparently. So I am not really advocating that they do that, so please don't. John Cena Rock stuff was kind of in stall mode this week. John Cena wasn't even on the show. He was at the show, but he wasn't on TV. Instead, they showed a John Cena promo package, which was pretty good. And I decided to do a search on Twitter, and I got tweets from people as well. But I was searching, you know, what people thought of the John Cena segment, and was amazed by some of the things that I saw. And there was one lady in particular who tweeted, this is what she tweeted. Okay, I'm just going to read this here. OMG, John Cena's wife divorced him because he lost the match against The Rock. You never loved John. I hope he doesn't take you back. Wow. That was a real tweet from a person. Somebody who actually thinks that John Cena's wife divorced him because he lost to The Rock at WrestleMania. And that was seemingly part of the story that they're pushing, because in the promo package, for the first time, they acknowledged on television, it was like a two-second shot, but they showed a TMZ headline from last year when John Cena was going through his divorce, his very real divorce. They acknowledged it on TV by showing that newspaper, well, not newspaper, but that website headline. And so apparently WWE is pushing, I don't know how hard they're going to push this, but at least in this segment, they're pushing the idea that among all the other crappy things that happened to John Cena in 2012, he got divorced in part because he was in a downward spiral since losing to The Rock at WrestleMania. Oh, there you go. That's the story they're telling. We had another moment on this show. Not the first time this has happened. It was about 10 after 10, okay? 3-hour show. It's 10:10 p.m., and Jerry Lawler comes at us with the line, we're just getting started. That's what Jerry Lawler said. 10 after 10, we're just getting started. 2 hours into Raw. Well, maybe he forgot to set his clock ahead for daylight savings. I don't know. The segment that I referred to earlier as being flabbergasting came in the third hour of this show. It was Chris Jericho's highlight reel. And they had the Jeritron 6000 or 7000, whatever they're up to by now. And the first thing Jericho does is he shows a movie trailer, which I think was for Wade Barrett's movie. I think. I can't remember. Anyway, the point is, when they came back from showing this movie trailer, the Jeritron 6000 had mysteriously disappeared. And from what I understand, the reason is because the screen didn't work. It stopped working. It wouldn't turn on. I thought maybe the thing, like, blew up. Started, you know, sparks started coming out of it. That would have been kind of funny. But the thing basically went kaput. So this segment was off to a rip-roaring start at this point. And what followed was a segment that involved Chris Jericho, Wade Barrett, and The Miz. And I don't know what happened here. But apparently whatever plans they had for this segment earlier in the day were nixed a few hours before showtime. I guess whatever they had planned was so goddamn awful that they had to come up with a plan B, and this was plan B, if you can believe that. They just went back and forth. Wade Barrett was insulting Jericho. Jericho was saying, I'm the person who has the most intercontinental title reigns. Maybe I'll beat you and I'll become a 10-time intercontinental champion, as though that would mean anything. Michael Cole at one point during this segment referred to it as the worst segment in Raw history, which I can tell you it was not. There have been a lot of goddamn awful segments in Raw history. This may be up there, but this ain't the worst. I don't know what the worst is, but it's not this. But this was pretty bad. And the fact that you have your lead announcer on commentary blatantly referring to it as the worst segment in the history of this television show, and him and Lawler were laughing, they were doing their you know, what they would usually do, the annoying stuff they have the announcers do. This segment was a tragedy, is what this segment was. And I found it interesting that in this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter that I was perusing through the other day, there was a mention that a lot of WWE talent, the next day, I guess, at the SmackDown tapings, the scuttlebutt in the locker room was about how bad Michael Cole was during that segment. They were speaking ill of Michael Cole for referring to the segment as being the worst in Raw history, and Cole was making one wisecrack after another about how bad that segment was as it was happening. Brad Maddox came out at some point during that segment, and apparently Brad Maddox, from what I understand, the fact that the Jeritron didn't work kind of fucked up Brad Maddox, because he was supposed to use the screen in some way or maybe throw to some footage on there, and because it wasn't working, he kind of got lost. That's why he was rambling during the promo. Everything about this segment was just an epic fail on every level. Brad Maddox was just the icing on the cake. He was terrible. And so anyway, the next day, the wrestlers are apparently talking about how Michael Cole didn't do that segment any favors, and he was saying how bad it was, and so that makes Michael Cole a bad announcer. The fact is, you know, Michael Cole is not out there saying these things on his own volition. He's saying whatever's told to him in his ear. I'm sure Vince McMahon is probably on headset saying, say that this is the worst segment in Raw history. Word for word, telling him exactly what he should be saying. I cannot see Michael Cole going into business for himself when you've got these three guys out there trying to have a segment, and on his own saying, this segment sucks. Because if he did, then he shouldn't be your lead announcer anymore. So I'm sure he was only doing what he's told. I don't understand why the wrestlers themselves can't grasp this concept. I mean, you work for the company, for crying out loud. If anything, they know how things go more than me and anybody else. So I'm kind of shocked, quite frankly, that they would be speaking ill of Michael Cole when even I can see it's not Michael Cole's fault. So I thought that's kind of dumb. I don't understand what's so hard for these wrestlers to understand about that. Main event was CM Punk and Kane. Kane very upset that CM Punk came out and interrupted his father's tribute earlier in the night, which led to this match. Apparently, CM Punk suffered some sort of arm injury during this match. He was not wrestling on the house shows this weekend. He should be okay for WrestleMania. I certainly hope so. I guess we'll find out, but he should be good to go for the big show. And here's how the main event played out. First of all, I mentioned the commercial break in the middle of this overrun, which... You know, I could see people tuning out of the show at that point and just saying, fuck this, I'm not sticking around. I mean, it's 11:05 and you're taking a commercial. It's just embarrassing. But Kane pinned CM Punk after Undertaker's gong distracted him. So let me get this straight. CM Punk is the WWE champion for 14 consecutive months. Nobody was able to beat him for the championship. Okay, he may have lost the match here and there. It's a tag match, or he lost by countout or whatever. But for 14 months, this guy was the champion of the world. Nobody was able to beat him. Look at all the people that Punk beat. He beat Dolph Ziggler. He beat Chris Jericho. He beat John Cena umpteen times. He beat The Big Show. He beat Ryback. I'm sure he beat Daniel Bryan. I'm sure there's a few other people I'm missing. And a gong causes him to lose in this match. Okay. Kane pins him with a choke slam. 1, 2, 3. We got the salute after that, which I thought was a really cool moment. Then Punk hits Kane from behind with the urn. Undertaker doesn't run down to the ring. He walks at a brisk pace down to the ring to go after Punk and assist his brother. And Punk runs up the aisleway with the urn, holds up the urn, and that's how Raw went off the air Monday night. You know, as much as they played up the death of Paul Bearer this week, it makes me wonder, you know, had he not died, what would they have had planned for Raw? Because this was the Paul Bearer show this week, and now apparently they're incorporating this into the storyline for this feud. Now, I will say that in reading the Observer this week, there was some more information about Eric Pankowski, who was the person that was recently let go. He was pretty much the head creative guy right below the McMahons. He was kind of the liaison between the writers and the McMahons. Because I guess the McMahons and Triple H, they don't interact too much with the writers directly. So he was kind of the head guy, and there was already some heat on him because the idea to have the four-way match a few weeks ago to determine who would face The Undertaker and try to break the streak at WrestleMania. Remember they did that match where it was Punk and I think Big Show, Sheamus, and Orton? That was his idea to do that. And what they had seemingly been building before that was this whole respect storyline. CM Punk would come out on TV, he would talk about respect, I am God, and it seemed like that was going to be the impetus for this match at WrestleMania. Either he would coax Undertaker coming out of retirement or whatever to face him, or The Undertaker would get tired of hearing CM Punk talk about what, you know, he's a god and he's the best in the world and respect this and respect that, and perhaps Undertaker would come out on his own. That seemed to be the direction they were going in. This was going to be the storyline based around this idea of respect. And I guess Pankowski had other ideas. He basically said, well, let's have a match to determine. It's almost like the number one contender to the streak or something like that. Well, now he's gone, and perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. Maybe that's why. He's out of the picture, and what we're left with now is, you know, basically CM Punk is running around with Paul Bearer's urn. And The Undertaker feels disrespected and he wants to get revenge, and I guess that's fine, but, you know, what would they have done if Paul Bearer didn't pass away? I mean, we'll never know, but it makes one wonder, because, you know, this was a very big part of the show this week, and I'm sure maybe the script got blown up. You know, what did it look like before that? I have no idea. I can't even venture a guess. There was a story this week about another WWE performer being busted for DUI. The dipshit in this case, Jimmy Uso. Jimmy Uso was arrested on Wednesday in Florida. He was charged with driving under the influence, according to the website for the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office. Wasn't in jail for very long, only a matter of hours. He got released on bond. And previously, he was arrested in September of 2011, also in Florida, on suspicion of driving under the influence. So this is not the first time that Jimmy Uso has been popped for DUI. And in that case, a police officer observed him at about 3 o'clock in the morning driving the wrong way down a one-way street in a Mustang. I believe that was the first time in 2011. And so here we are in 2013, and this is now his second DUI arrest, and I think you know what I would do if I were in charge. This guy should no longer be under contract. Simple as that. Like I said, if Jack Swagger got popped for DUI, he was driving 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, but he got caught with pot, and he was arrested on suspicion of driving while under the influence, whatever your opinions may be about what that means for, let's say, a pot smoker as opposed to somebody who's been drinking and driving, you're still being arrested for driving under the influence. And I think that Swagger should have been fired. I still do. I don't know if they're going to punish him after WrestleMania or not. He hasn't been punished so far. But that's what I would have done, to put my foot down and set an example that this DUI shit is not going to be tolerated. I mean, if it were my company, I would be embarrassed by this. I don't want people working for me who are getting popped left and right for DUI. So this is the second DUI arrest for a WWE star in the last few weeks. And they didn't do anything to Swagger. So now they've set a precedent here. Because even though I would get rid of Jimmy Uso, if you do something to him, if you punish him, if you fire him, you're opening up a whole can of worms here because you just had somebody else get arrested for the same thing. And maybe the circumstances here are different. Maybe they're worse. I don't know. These are all the details I have right now. It's a problem because you can't treat people differently. You know, if they're arrested for the same thing, if they commit a crime, they should be punished, whether that's a suspension, if that's being fired, if that's being fined, whatever it is. And they seemingly didn't do anything to Swagger. So how could they do something to Uso? That's not right. Now, in his case, this is the second time. So that may be their way out. This is not his first offense. It's his second offense, which really is just so much worse. I hate to say it because it kind of fucks over Jey Uso. Apparently he didn't do anything wrong. But his brother is a bozo. And Jimmy Uso, if I were running that company, Jimmy Uso would be wish well on his future endeavors. If he gets his act together, I'd be more than happy to have him back. But if I'm running that company, I can't tolerate that sort of behavior. You know, when do you start to set an example? You got to make an example out of somebody. I thought Swagger would be the perfect person because Swagger is their golden boy right now. You know, he's in a world title match at WrestleMania. Jimmy Uso probably wasn't even going to be on the WrestleMania card. But for them to take a stand against somebody like Swagger, who's in a major storyline that they just came up with, I think would have sent a powerful message. So here's another individual, you know, doing something incredibly stupid, who quite frankly should be fired. And I guess we'll see if they get rid of him or if they don't do anything at all. I guess we'll find out. If you have a question for the Sound Off or a shout-out you'd like me to try to read on the air, you can email that to me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. Before we get to your mailbag questions, there is a shout-out from Joe from Crown Point, Indiana, who I want to read this here. This was left for me in iTunes. He was very nice enough to leave a review for the show, as I sometimes ask you guys to do in iTunes. And I just want to read part of this here. He says, I've been a wrestling fan my whole life. Earliest memories are the build-up to WrestleMania 3. I've listened to the Sound Off since the summer of 2010. I never miss an episode and often replay the episode a few times every week. Solemonster has a talent for recapping all the major events and filling in some cracks here and there. I truly appreciate the logical opinions of storylines, as logical as pro wrestling stories can be, of course, and enjoy how each show is pretty unique unto itself. The show has news, insights, humor, and some real-life stuff mixed in. I have subscribed and unsubscribed to many wrestling podcasts. Most are extremely lame. I've settled on 3, and the Sound Off is my favorite, followed closely by Colt Cabana's show. Keep up the good work, and I thank you for being a logical voice of wrestling fans everywhere. So that came from Joe from Crown Point. I just wanted to mention that on the air and say thank you to Joe for leaving that review. It was very kind, and I certainly encourage other people to do the same thing. It helps the show immensely when you leave feedback in iTunes. So, and if you do that and you can make me aware of it, I'm more than happy to give you a shout-out on the air. So let's get to your question. Zach Holker writes in. He says, I think a significant amount of time has passed since Jerry Lawler had his heart attack, and although I feel bad for what he's gone through, my opinion of his commentary has not changed, with both announcers being baby faces and the painful amount of social media and sponsor plugs every 5 minutes driving me up a wall. Though I feel WWE should keep Jerry at the booth for his loyalty to the business, what is your opinion of his commentary, and could you see a heel babyface partnership at the booth in the near future? Also, can I just say that I love your Twitter profile page? Well, of course you can. And if anyone listening to this isn't following me there, you should follow me there too, @Solemonster. My opinion of Lawler's commentary hasn't changed in years. Go back and listen to Sound Off 234. It was about a month before he had the heart attack. I did a whole segment where I kind of reached my breaking point with Jerry Lawler on commentary, and I suggested 3 different scenarios on how to go about replacing him. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, firing him or taking him off TV altogether. I came up with three different solutions, one of which was to bring back JBL, which, of course, they have since done. This was before JBL came back. One other suggestion I had was to give Scott Stanford a shot. Scott Stanford is an announcer. You may recognize him from some of Zack Ryder's old YouTube shows. I don't think he's a bad announcer at all, and I think he actually has done or does do the announcing for Superstars. I don't get to watch Superstars, so I don't know if he's still doing commentary for that show. And I think WWE may be a part-time gig for him only because he still does the local sports reports here for our NBC affiliate in New York. He is an actual newsman, and I just saw him actually the other night doing sports on WNBC. So it could just be an issue where maybe that's just too much for him. He's not a full-time WWE performer, so he couldn't do it. He would be somebody I would want to give a shot to. I think Josh Matthews is okay, but he's somewhat boring. Scott Stanford has some personality. I mean, why not give him a shot? The other thing that I suggested, which perhaps is my favorite idea, you know, Raw is 3 hours, and back in the day, the old WCW Monday Nitro formula, even when they were 2 hours, was to split up the announce teams. You would have one announce team for hour one, and you would have a different team for hour two. I think hour one would have Schiavone and Zbyszko, and I think the second hour would have Schiavone and Bobby Heenan and Mike Tenay, or something like that. So now you have Raw as a three-hour show. That's a long time to be on the air. So why not break them up and have two separate announce crews for half, you know, one half of the show is Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, and the second half is Jim Ross and JBL. Or you have Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler, and you have Michael Cole and JBL, which might make more sense because those pairings have more chemistry together. You know, Ross and Lawler obviously have chemistry. They work together for years. JBL and Cole are very good friends. They have their own YouTube show on WWE.com. They do their own podcast on Layfield Report. To see them doing commentary together would also make sense. So why not break them up and split the announce crews up for the show? Because the less of Lawler we have, the less infuriated you would be. You know, maybe he's burned out. Maybe that's why he doesn't care. You know, I think the biggest reason is because babyface Jerry Lawler just simply is not as entertaining as heel Jerry Lawler. And to answer that part of your question, I mean, he's never going to be a heel again. So if you're looking for that, it ain't going to happen. The closest thing we have to a heel announcer these days really is JBL. And I wouldn't even call him a heel announcer. You know, he tries to be fair sometimes. If anything, I would compare JBL more to what Jesse Ventura used to be. Jesse Ventura would certainly cheer for some of the heels, but I always looked at Jesse as being the voice of reason in the announce booth because there were many times when he was doing announcing with Vince McMahon or doing announcing with Tony Schiavone or doing announcing with Gorilla Monsoon where Jesse, the heel announcer, so to speak, would make some very valid points. You know, if Gorilla Monsoon refused to take a babyface to task for cheating because, well, the other guy cheats, so it's fair play. You know, there Ventura would be right there to say, are you kidding me? That's ridiculous. That's a double standard. You know, if you don't like it when this guy cheats, how do you like it when this guy cheats? And he would make some very valid points. And I kind of look at JBL the same way. I think sometimes he keeps the other announcers in place. He keeps them honest. He's the closest thing you're going to get, I think, to a heel announcer these days. It's just not a formula they choose to go with anymore. And if you want to hear more JBL, just watch SmackDown. That's his show. I think he's back on TV this week. He climbed the mountain. He was not successful. I think he ran into some weather issues. He blogged about his whole experience on the mountain on LayfieldReport.com. So he should be back on TV this week. Shane from Fort Lauderdale, Florida writes, and I've been a longtime listener since the 40s, and I enjoy the sound off. I've been going through hard times the past few weeks, and I'd like to ask for a shout-out. I visited the hospital twice with a lung problem, and my dad had a mini heart attack himself. It's been hard the past few weeks, but better days are ahead. My question for you is, do you think WWE would ever take somebody out of the Hall of Fame as a consequence of their actions? Well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your dad. Hope he's doing well, and I hope you're doing okay as well. Lung problems are no joke. I don't know how serious it is, but get well. I do think they would quietly drop somebody from the Hall of Fame if they did something really egregious, like commit a serious crime. If Chris Benoit was already in the WWE Hall of Fame before he murdered his family, I have no doubt they would have removed him right away. You know, they would not necessarily even make a whole big spectacle about it because It's easier for them because there is no physical Hall of Fame building. You don't have to physically go in there and take down his pictures and take down his plaques and if there's a whole exhibit. You know, you don't have to do that. There's no physical Hall of Fame, not yet. So all they'd have to do is just very quietly remove him from their website and remove all future mentions of him from their Hall of Fame video packages. They won't even have to say a word. I'm sure it would create a shitstorm on the internet once people realized what they had done, but it's their Hall of Fame. They could do whatever they want. You know, murder, I think, is something that might earn you expulsion from the Hall of Fame. I personally would have no problem with that. I mean, it would have to be something really, really serious. I would throw rape in there, but they just inducted Mike Tyson into their Hall of Fame last year. So that would be a little bit hypocritical, I would think, of them to throw somebody out of the Hall of Fame for a rape conviction. Super schmuck Billy Graham is still crowing about how he wants WWE to take him out of their Hall of Fame because they inducted Abdullah the Butcher. And they haven't done that. It would take a lot, I think, for them to take somebody out of the Hall of Fame, but I could see them doing it. Alex from Chicago was at the Impact tapings this past Thursday. He has some attendance notes for us. The whole lower deck was filled except for a few seats and a section blocked off with the camera. They even had to open up seats in the upper deck due to the capacity being filled in the lower bowl. The suites were also predominantly filled, which is an awesome sign. This is the third TNA show I've ever been to, my previous two being Slammiversary 05 at the Impact Zone and Bound for Glory 08 at the Sears Center in Chicago. The appearance of it all looked 100 times better than it did back at Bound for Glory, which is great for TNA to up its production in just 4 years. If I were to guess, it looked like close to maybe 6,000 people were there, which I believe would be TNA's biggest crowd ever. Well, not ever. They've had larger crowds in the UK, but the legit attendance, as I said earlier, was about 6,700, which is not bad at all. Except, again, they were in the Alamo Dome, which fits a hell of a lot more than 6,700 people. Joshua writes in, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, do you think with Bully Ray as champion, things are bound to get edgier? Bully was already the best heel. Now, with him being more of a focal point, do you think he'll turn it up a notch? I already think he is. He almost came to blows with a fan in the crowd on Thursday. I guess some fan took a swing at him as the Aces and Eights were heading back through the crowd after the first taping ended. And I mean, Bully in the original ECW was brutal to the fans. I mean, the things he said, the riots that he nearly instigated, I mean, you don't see that anymore in wrestling. He won't be able to go that far. You know, TNA and Spike would never allow it. But I say let him rile people up. Let him push the envelope a little bit. We have not seen a heel like that in a long time. We see so many heels, like cool heels who get cheered or they want to get cheered. And I mean, even the ones who don't want to get cheered get cheered. Bully, you know, at least on Thursday, he was getting the reaction that you would expect somebody like him to get. You know, the fans were being pretty cooperative. But and maybe it's a TNA thing. You know, their fans, generally speaking, you know, tend to be more well-behaved is the right word. Not well-behaved. I mean, obviously they were throwing trash at the ring. Well-behaved in that, I think more often they will give you the reaction that you're looking for, and the best example I could give is Joseph Park. I can't imagine all those months ago, you know, in the Impact Zone, it's not like he was going out there every week getting chance of your abyss or stuff like that. The fans, you know, were playing along with the storyline, I think, more than any WWE crowd would. And I don't know, maybe it's a TNA thing or maybe it's just me, but Bully got, you know, tremendous heel heat on Thursday. And I think if they just continue to let him be the heel that he can be, I think it's going to be a very entertaining you know, six months or more that he should be the champion in TNA. So I, for one, hope they let him do that. Barry Wright was also in Chicago at the tapings on Thursday. He writes in, a few things I noticed. When they would come back from commercial, the announcers would say they were going to give a backstage pass to the loudest audience member as a way to get the crowd to look hot on camera, which is strange because the crowd was already really into the show. TNA did not acknowledge that it was a double taping until the very end, after some fans had already left. You would think they would have at least printed that on the tickets. Otherwise, a very fun show. Every commercial break, the crowd was just so dead and dark. Security was pointless. We had VIP seats, and some of us just walked down to the front row. Good to go to a wrestling show and not hear little kids scream for Cena. Speaking of Barry, Walter also wrote into the Sound Off. He's been listening since somewhere around episode 130. Walter says, I'd like to request a shout-out for my fellow Sound-Off listener and friend Barry Wright, a.k.a. Ryback opponent Dan Barone from SmackDown last year. Barry is having a benefit screening for his documentary Life on the Ropes on April 6th in the south suburbs of Chicago. Barry was dropped from his insurance when he was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma in 2010 at just 21 years of age. He beat the stage 2 cancer in 11 months of intense chemotherapy and radiation treatments. However, both Illinois Medicaid and the American Cancer Society denied him financial help because you have to be sick for a full year or worse to qualify for their aid. All proceeds from the screening will go directly to Barry and his family to help pay off his medical bills. I have attached links to the trailer and Facebook page and would really appreciate it if you could spread the word about the documentary. Barry has a real inspiring story. He's a good guy. He is a big fan of the Sound Off. You can visit the official Facebook page for this by going to facebook.com/lifeontheropes, all one word. Or you can go to the website code10studios.net if you want to see the trailer that Walter has put together. That's code, the number 10, studios.net. So you can show your support for Barry by going there. Matt I writes in, do you think Goldberg's run in WWE was a total flop? I wasn't really watching the product at the time, but I've heard stories that he and WWE just didn't get along, mainly creative differences and money issues. Can you analyze Goldberg's short run in WWE and tell me what you think went wrong and why? Who's to blame, if anyone? Also, do you think we'll ever see Big Bill in a WWE ring again? Personally, I think a Goldberg-Ryback match would be quite the spectacle. Back in WWE, no. No, not in the ring. And yes, that would be a spectacle. I don't know that it would necessarily be a good spectacle, but it would certainly be a spectacle. And I think it would be death for Ryback. If you get to turn Ryback heel, then fine. But if you want to still get Ryback over as a babyface monster, the worst thing that you could do is bring in Bill Goldberg, because all it's going to do is draw attention to the fact that this guy is a Goldberg clone, at least in some ways. Okay, he's not exactly a Goldberg clone, but he's getting the Goldberg push. And he still gets Goldberg chance, not as much. You bring Goldberg in, and you're really putting the screws to Ryback. I would not do that. Was his run a total flop? Absolutely not. You know, the man beat The Rock in his first match. He eventually beat Triple H, became the World Heavyweight Champion. Now, was he booked properly? That's debatable. Was he as hot as he was in WCW during his peak? Not even close. I point to SummerSlam that year as a real turning point, and not in a good way, for Goldberg. Goldberg was in an Elimination Chamber match at SummerSlam in 2003. It was an Elimination Chamber match that also included, if I remember correctly, I think Kevin Nash and Shawn Michaels and Triple H. You know, Triple H obviously was in there. Triple H at the time was suffering from a groin injury. And so instead of taking time off or vacating the title or whatever, he wrestled with the injury. This was during Triple H's biker shorts phase where he looked awful. He looked bloated and terrible, and he wore these really, really, really tight biker shorts, pants, whatever the hell they were. You know, presumably he wore them that way on purpose because the tighter it was, probably the less pain he felt from the groin. So he looked completely ridiculous. He wasn't even 100%. And so they're in this Elimination Chamber match. And there's a spot in the match where Goldberg just becomes a house of fire. And Goldberg is killing everybody. He's killing dudes. I think Jericho may have been in there. He's killing dudes left and right. The crowd is going ape shit for Bill Goldberg. And I'm watching this thinking, this is the way Goldberg should be booked. He had not been booked up to that point in WWE to resemble the Goldberg from WCW. This was the first time in WWE that he truly looked like the monster that he was at his peak in WCW, and the fans were into it. The fans were not booing, you know, as they would sometimes do. If somebody from the outside came in, they're you know, not a WWE guy, they're a rival WCW guy. No, the fans were into this, and that was the moment. That was the time that was right. You talk about striking while the iron's hot. That night, Goldberg should have become the World Heavyweight Champion. It should have come down to him and Triple H in that chamber, and he should have won the championship. And instead, they did this fuck finish. Triple H, of course, was part of Evolution at the time, and so I think Flair maybe somehow fed the sledgehammer to him inside the chamber, which I guess is easy enough to do. You stick the sledgehammer through the chain link fence. And Goldberg, I think, went for a spear, and as he went for a spear, Triple H hit him in the head with the sledgehammer and got the pin. I think that was the finish. And you could just feel the air just completely deflate from the arena. And the way they ended the pay-per-view that night was they kind of, I think, handcuffed Goldberg to the to the Elimination Chamber fence and they beat him up and he was left all bloodied and stuff. And, you know, it was just the wrong moment for that. He should have won the championship that night. And instead, they waited another month. And they waited so they could have a Goldberg-Triple H singles match at the I think it was Unforgiven was the name of that pay-per-view at the time. And Goldberg won the championship, but it wasn't the same. The fans weren't as into it. And they made another very cardinal mistake with Goldberg with that match, which is that Goldberg should not have been booked to be in matches that were terribly long. You know, I understand that Goldberg can't just have 3-minute matches every week, but they booked this long, tedious, normal, average wrestling match. And I think Triple H had the heat for most of the match on Goldberg, and then he finally, you know, he had his big comeback at the end, but the fans just were not as into it. Maybe it was the arena setting, I don't know. But the bloom was off the rose at that point, even the night he won the championship, because they fucked up and they should have had him win it a month earlier. And that just goes to show you that sometimes you have to strike while the iron's hot. You wait a few weeks, you wait a month, it could be too late. And I think in that situation with Goldberg, it was too late. He might have had a fighting chance had he won the championship in the chamber, because he looked like an unstoppable force in there. And that momentum could have carried him beyond that. But, I mean, by the time that September pay-per-view rolled around, the momentum was gone. And then 3 months later, he lost the championship back to Triple H. I think it was in a triple threat match against him and Kane. It was either Survivor Series or Armageddon. It was one of those two shows. So putting him in long matches exposed him. It didn't do him any favors. The other thing also is I remember reading that there was a lot of heat on Goldberg at the time from some of the people backstage on the fact that he had a very easy schedule. Goldberg negotiated a very lucrative contract for himself where he did not have to wrestle house shows. He had a certain number of dates that he would work every month. It's not unlike a contract that somebody like Brock Lesnar has now. WWE now seems more open to bringing in old guys, top guys, with special deals, which I think is the right thing to do. You have to be flexible. I mean, if you can get somebody like The Rock or Brock Lesnar to come in and wrestle some pay-per-view matches, then fuck, man, give them whatever deal needs to be made, negotiate that deal. And if people are going to be upset about that, then let them be upset. So back then, people were very upset that bringing in Goldberg, he doesn't have to work house shows. He's not one of us. So there was a lot of heat on him for that. There was a lot of jealousy on him because of that. He got paid a lot of money to not do as much work as other people were doing. And what those people just don't understand, while I can understand the frustration, is that, you know, Goldberg didn't end up having the impact that he could have had and that maybe I thought he would have in WWE, but you didn't know that going in. Goldberg was the biggest name that WCW ever made. You could say Sting was, but go back to that Monday Night Wars period. Goldberg was the only big name like that that they really made. You know, DDP became a star. There were some people like that. None of them were as big as Goldberg at his peak. And if I had the opportunity to bring him in, then I want to bring him in and hope that he can replicate some of that enthusiasm that he had in WCW. It didn't happen. But I don't fault them for making the deal. But so there was a lot of heat on him for a lot of different reasons. He and Triple H never got along. Triple H, Shawn Michaels, they still don't think very highly of him. I think Goldberg's name has come up before for the Hall of Fame. I think his name may have come up in the year they had WrestleMania a few years ago in Atlanta, because Atlanta was his backyard, of course, in WCW, and I think Triple H was arguing against it, and I don't know if that's the reason why they ended up not, you know, putting him in the Hall of Fame, but I don't have a lot of optimism, especially when Triple H takes over for good. You know, him and Goldberg, things didn't end well with them. I don't see Goldberg being high on the priority list of people to put in the Hall of Fame once Triple H is in charge. So that's really where a lot of it comes from. Ivan from Houston, Texas writes in, I've been listening to the show since the beginning of 2011. I would like to get a birthday shout out. I celebrated my 24th on March 9th, I should say. But was so busy with midterms, I didn't have the chance to write in. Huge fan of the show. Hope your success with JBL's blog will lead to better things with WWE. I do have a question for you. You say Stone Cold turning at WrestleMania 17 was a horrible idea. If that's the case, when would you think have been a good time to turn him? Should he have just stayed babyface? And if so, wouldn't that make him dull after a while, just like John Cena? I think Austin was already getting stale by that point. To me, he was never the same after he left for neck surgery in 99. You know, and certainly in hindsight, it was a bad decision. And yes, I would not have turned him at WrestleMania 17. They were in Texas, for crying out loud. Why would you do that? You know? It's not even like they got the reaction they were looking for. I'm certain that when Steve Austin was done obliterating The Rock with a steel chair and pinned him, they were not anticipating that the crowd would quite literally leap to their feet and explode when he won the championship. That's not how you book a heel turn. And they were in the heart of Texas. How could they not have foreseen that happening? It just wasn't the right time. And even more important than that, you know, why I feel this way, they knew that The Rock was going away for a few months to go film a movie. He was filming his part in The Mummy Returns. Now, if they would have turned Triple H babyface, which is what they teased doing, remember the next night on Raw, they had an Austin Rock cage match rematch. That was Rock's last match before he went away. And they had Triple H run out with the sledgehammer, teasing that he was going to attack Vince and attack Austin, and the fans were going nuts, and instead Triple H hit The Rock with the sledgehammer, and the two-man power trip was formed. Now, I know a lot of people look back very fondly on the two-man power trip, which didn't last very long because Triple H tore his quad the next month, but the fact is, the politics of it are very interesting, that Triple H would prefer to team with Steve Austin and kind of glom off some of his heat rather than oppose him, perhaps because Triple H knew they weren't going to take the title off Austin so quickly, and so perhaps Triple H, the smart man that he is, didn't want to... Yeah, he wasn't interested in feuding with Austin and jobbing to him, so instead he pushed to team with him, hence the two-man power trip. It's funny how that works. But they did tease turning Triple H babyface, and again, instead of doing that, they aligned him with Austin. So what that means is they have no top babyface. I mean, at least if Triple H would have turned face, they would have made a new top babyface to feud with Austin coming out of Mania for a few months, but they had nobody. They had Undertaker and Kane, neither of whom were going to be the top babyface. So one of your two top babyfaces is leaving to film a movie and you turn the other one heel? It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, maybe their logic was that it would build a major heel for The Rock to feud with when he got back. But when Rock came back, he didn't even feud with Steve Austin. He was wrestling, you know, Booker T and Chris Jericho for the WCW title. Maybe they could have built to a unification match at WrestleMania 18. They could have, you know, WWF title against WCW title, Rock versus Austin 3. But they didn't do it. I would have held off on turning Austin heel until they had one or two other top babyfaces who could really step into that role once he turned, and turn him once you start seeing the fans going against him. I know some people might hear that and say, oh, well, then it's too late. No, it's not. That's a sign that the people are ready for it to happen. You don't want to wait until the crowds are all just booing him the way they boo Cena now. But you can read the fans, you can read the tea leaves and kind of see when people are starting to get tired of it and starting to turn against him. I mean, do you know how badly Hulk Hogan was being booed by WCW crowds in 1995 and 96 before they finally turned him heel? He was getting booed mercifully. He was like the John Cena of WCW for a while back then with some of the reactions he was getting. And WCW would try to, you know, do what they could to mask that reaction and stuff. They would pay people to hold up Hulk Hogan signs and wear Hulk Hogan merchandise in the front row, and they would edit their tape shows so you wouldn't hear the boos, and they would pipe in cheers. They did everything in their power to try to make it seem like Hulk Hogan was still the most over babyface in the world, but he wasn't. And that was for a while before they finally turned him heel, and guess what? I think he did pretty damn well after that. So that's what I would have done. That's what I would have waited for with Steve Austin. That's it for the mailbag. You can email me your questions at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please try to include how long you've been listening to the show for. If you have an episode number that you remember when you started listening, I'm always interested to find out when people started listening to the Sound Ups. Many of you have been listening for a very long time, and I appreciate that. You can follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. There's always a lot of activity going on there. Any breaking news and stuff, comments, it usually goes up first on my Twitter page. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. You can be part of our very active Raw thread debate every single Monday night during the show. It's 3 hours long. So the best way I can pitch this and sell this is 3 hours is a long-ass time. Raw can sometimes drag a lot. It could just come to a screeching halt. It could be very difficult to get through these shows. One way to pass the time and entertain yourself is to be part of the discussion thread on our Facebook page. So you got to send me a friend request on there. I'll approve you, and you can be part of that And you can also subscribe to the show in iTunes. Type in Solid Monster Sounds Off, and you can automatically subscribe to the show. Every time a new episode goes up, it will be downloaded for you. And I want to make mention here also, I want to thank you for helping to make the Sound Off the number two sports podcast on all of Podbean last week. We were second only to Live Audio Wrestling, and not bad company to have. So I thank you for that. I thank you for your continued support. Please check out my next Walking Dead blog. It'll be up on layfieldreport.com in addition to blogging about wrestling. I am their resident Walking Dead blogger. There's only about three episodes left, I think, of the show for this season. Best show on TV. And my next review, if not late tonight, should be up sometime tomorrow morning. So be sure to check that out if you are a Walking Dead fan. We will be back here next weekend with episode 266 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off. So until then, be well. Stay safe. In the next few weeks, I'll have some more information on our special show that we will be doing as part of WrestleMania 29 weekend. I know everybody really had fun with and enjoyed the roundtable show we did with myself, Brian Blade, and Noah Mark last year in Miami. We plan on doing something very similar again this year here in New York. So it's coming up in the next few weeks. I'll have more on that in the near future. So keep listening to the Sound Off for updates on that. Until next time, we'll see you right back here on SEScoops.com. Take care, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solid Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.